If I ended up getting prescription dyslexia instead of taking one every 8 hours, start taking eight every 1 hour. And it was just off to the races, man.
I think I had that too.
I was literally living a double life.
If it hadn't been Laguna, what show would you have chosen to get?
None of them. You know, he looked at me and he's just like, Mom and I are like two planks of wood lying in bed waiting for the phone call that you're dead. It was a very low point, man. You know, your greatest deficits can become your greatest assets. This could be the last day that you ever have to feel like this.
This is Rooted Recovery Stories. I'm Patrick Custer, your host. So excited to be here with each and every one of you. And my guest today, you might know him from quite a few different things, the Hills, Laguna Beach, and a lot of the good stuff he's doing in the public eye now. Jason Waller, such an honor for you to be here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, man. Grateful to be here and grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're here in Music Row in Nashville, where you now call home.
Yes, we moved here about 2 years ago.
And so what's the story behind that?
Oh my gosh, man. You know, basically leaving Orange County was a big decision. We have 22 family members that are reside there. And, but just growing up there, I wanted to provide a different quality of life for my children. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to have a more wholesome upbringing and kind of get out of the pretentious, fast paced life of Orange County. And, we've achieved that. You know, when we moved here within 24 hours, we had three little girls knock on our front door and ask my daughter to come out and play, and just stuff I haven't seen since I was a kid. You know what I mean? And you go outside our front door and you see go-karts and people on quads ripping up and down the road. Like, that's the type of lifestyle I wanted to provide. And, yeah. And just the school systems are incredible here. The people, it's just a better way of living in my eyes, right? Different strokes, different folks. It's just where I was at in my life. And just what me and my wife were talking about, because if we didn't have kids, I don't know that we would have left, just because so much family was there. Mm-hmm. But due to the fact that it's not about us anymore and it's about our children, we had to look at what we felt was most appropriate for them.
Yeah, that's great. So no regrets?
No regrets, man. It's funny you asked that, because I'll never forget, my wife and kids flew over here with, you know, my mother-in-law, and I was driving with my dog and one little trailer behind me is, you know, following our moving trucks. And I'm like, dude, what am I doing? As like, I get to New Mexico, I'm like, why am I leaving? And I'm just like, whatever, you know, 50-50, like, we get there, we can move back. You know, the kids are young, we're not going to uproot them and stuff. And, so I think when I came here, I was like, really, you know, I just was going for, we're just going for it. Right.
Yeah.
But after the first year of us being here, I kind of went through like a grieving process of like, we're not going back, you know? And so, which is a beautiful thing, but it's also hard. I mean, especially when you're, you know, my parents, who I'm very close with, are getting older, and you know, it's not a 2 hour drive away even.
Right.
It's, you know, you're a 4 hour flight. And so there's things that are challenging, but, outside of that, I'm really happy and content with what we decided to do.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's great. I love living here, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I'm glad to hear that. How often do you get to go back?
Man, the first year I went back almost too much. I think I was there like over a dozen times, and that was a lot correlated with work and stuff like that. But, moving forward, we try to get out there once a quarter.
Yeah.
But everybody comes and visits us too. So it makes it nice.
It's a nice place to visit here.
Yeah. It's both. It's, I love visiting, you know, again, I'm grateful that we don't have to. You know, it's a great place to visit now.
Yeah. A lot of people have to visit other places I won't name that aren't quite as lovely as going to Laguna Beach. Yeah. You know? Right. So, yeah,
not a bad trade.
Right. For sure. Well, so moving backwards, before, you know, what we all know from you being on the camera and your life in the public eye, mm-hmm. You kind of made a reference to it earlier, your childhood and what that was like. I kind of wonder if you would paint a picture for us about that.
Yeah. I mean, in the aspect of, you know, I mean, I had an amazing childhood, parents who are both very loving and caring. They just actually celebrated 50 years of marriage and had an awesome environment to grow up in. I was the youngest of four kids, was very active in sports. I loved baseball, loved surfing, loved skateboarding, loved snowboarding, wakeboarding. I had a really like idyllic, you know, life, childhood. But at the age of 13, and I tell people now that I struggled, I can see after doing 20 years of work, I can see how I struggled with addiction way before I ever picked up the drink or the drug. And what I mean by that is at 12 or 13 years old, I ended up having severe OCD to the point where I would wash my hands till they'd bleed, and I'd have to wear neoprene gloves at night just to deal with the hands cracking. Again, parents, you know, we had resources and were able to see doctors and psychologists, and I was put on an SSRI, you know, to help mitigate the symptoms, but ultimately never dealt with the underlying issue, right? And fast forward a few years, you know, come to find alcohol and, you know, off to the races. And that's when the addiction started. And so when I say, though, I can see that I struggled with, you know, with alcoholism or drinking or addiction before I ever picked up the drink or the drug. It was the internal feelings that I was having. It was the, you know, the negative self-talk, you know, the depression, the anxiety, the self-hatred, all those things that existed, that were going on internally, that I didn't know how to express, you know. And back then my parents, again, they tried doing everything they could. This is 20 sure. plus years ago. Yeah. But as a 12-year-old, how am I supposed to try to describe this? And that's what the craziest part was, is because I was literally living a double life. As you know, this was what was going on internally at home, but on the outside, I was a popular kid. I was, you know, I was good at sports. I was athletic. I was able to kind of have this lifestyle over here and project what I wanted people to see, but not really know what was going on. So I already started living a double life at 12, 13 years old, which was another really challenging, you know, thing to deal with and cope with, and even try to express that. Like, I didn't even if I wanted to, I didn't know how to explain what was right. going on. But there's a whole crazy story about, I can share with you down the road. I can share with you now.
Let's do it. We love crazy stories.
Well, it's so 20 years later, after you know the dozen treatment centers that I went to, the trials and tribulations I had with the law, you know, did a lot of work, worked on myself, was in and out of therapy, you know, the majority of my life and stuff, and actually connected with Dr. Amen, who I work with now, and I actually did his show Scan My Brain. And come to find out 20 years later, just about a year and a half ago, after I did the show, he was able to identify that I had PANDAS, which is basically a part of the virus of strep throat that attacks a part of your brain that creates OCD.
What?
And so had I known that information or that knowledge as a 12 or 13 year old kid, to be like, dude, you're not a freak, you're not a weirdo, you know, all those different things that were accumulating would have been life changing. But it was just fascinating to see how much, you know, we've made in modern advancement with this, with how we are looking at mental health and underlying issues, to provide clarity, right? And because knowledge is power, and it would have been much more instrumental for me. Not, and again, now that I know that, it's not like, hey, here's a cure, but it's the treatments and the different variances that I would have taken to achieve success or to help combat what I was dealing with would have been totally different. And so it's interesting for me to kind of see how this has all come to fruition. But it's also, it gives me hope that there's a lot more that's out there today to provide people with some guidance.
Well, absolutely. I think on that note, the tools that we have that you're speaking to, but especially I know, you know, I feel like, you know, as you were talking about as a child, that you didn't have the vocabulary to, share or even speak and understand what was going on inside you. And now I know we so much in school and in different environments where we're teaching children, they're learning vocabulary about talking about their emotions and the importance of that. And, you know, the wheel that we see of all the different, like, I mean, I don't remember learning about any of that until I was a full blown adult past recovery, you know, doing therapy. And, you know, when we have the tools to communicate or identify what it is, what you're talking about is the whole feeling of being less alone.
Yeah.
And that's what I think that, like, what you're doing with your platform today, what we're doing, trying to do with this podcast in the world of just helping people and breaking stigma when they feel less alone with what they're suffering with.
Yeah, 100%.
It's one of the first steps to acceptance.
Yeah, no, it is. But I mean, it's, you know, it's important that you're, you know, I mean, if I were to identify my sobriety into like the four key elements of it, is God, foundation, fellowship, and service, right? And I mean, the fellowship is the like-mindedness, the connection, the connectivity, the relatability.
Yeah, most definitely. So I want to go back just a second. What was the, when alcohol was introduced into your life, was it early age or?
I was just on a panel the other day, and it was funny. It came back to me because the question was, what was my first interaction or use of alcohol? And the first time I'd used, like, I mean, like went to intentionally go, you know, go get drunk is I was actually like terrified. Me and three of my buddies, you know, had his older brother go and get us some drinks. And, I think he got us like a 12 pack or whatever, like probably 14. And I remember they had a couple drinks and they're starting to get sloshy and I kept like pouring it over my shoulder, like, yeah, man, it's great. And like, but it just, I was watching them and I was just, and I don't know why it's interesting because I, there was this, my first interaction with it, there was this fear and I don't even know where that really stemmed from. I just, maybe it was not having control or just seeing kind of what was going on with them, considering everything that was going on with me internally, you'd think, you know, you'd want to probably escape a little bit. Mm-hmm. But that, I remember that very, very clearly. There's a ton of things that I can't share that happened that were absolutely hilarious. Just not appropriate. And I remember it all. They don't. And then I don't remember like my first like real like interaction. There's like a blur from there to like, I remember like it fast forward and I remember just getting ripped, you know, from like 16, 17, 18. It was just off to the races.
Yeah.
But I don't remember like that for, I don't like have this, I remember this, that first time where I was like, you know, I had this romanticization of the drink. And, I just remember it went from 0 to 100. And I don't remember what that moment was or where that was. And it's funny though, as I'm getting more clarity and having more and more sobriety, I'm starting to remember more and more stuff because there's a period in my time, literally from 18 to 23, I don't really remember much. And again, this, what we're talking about is even prior to that, but it's funny how things are starting to come back. Some good, some bad, some ugly. And it's interesting how the brain is resilient and healing itself.
It is. I think this is just my own assumption, but for my own journey, but I feel like, you know, we know the neuroplasticity of the brain and healing itself is one thing, but I think there's also something I think God just like put in our brain, our healing process to that we aren't, stuff isn't revealed to us until we're able to deal with it. Like, you know, the thing that you got to deal with first, you deal with, and then the next thing is shown to you, you know, at least that's what it's been like for me.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful that that process is in place because I don't know that I could have handled 5 years ago what has come back to me, you know, at 10 and 12 years sober.
Yeah.
And
God's got his timing. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right. What did you want to be what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a baseball player.
Really?
Yeah. That's what I wanted. I mean, I was my goals, my dreams, my aspiration. I definitely wanted to be a baseball player for sure.
Awesome. So you said you play sports. Did you play baseball?
I played baseball. Okay. I played all the way until my drinking took over. And, that was my career transitioned into becoming a professional drinker.
Yeah.
But no, I played baseball all the way up through high school and, actually had some opportunities that were there for baseball, but didn't pursue those, because with the show and the drinking and different opportunities that came up, my priorities shifted.
Sure.
Again, it's
I can only imagine.
Not necessarily, you know, again, I don't like dwell on it. There's, you know, it's like, if you look back like, oh, I wish I would have done something like, yeah, I wish I would have pursued that in a different area, and tried that. But it's, again, as I'm very grateful for, I think everything happens for a reason and allowed me to be where I am today.
Yeah. So the way things happened, how did they happen? What led to you getting on Laguna?
Laguna was the first show. I was actually out in Provo, Utah at boarding school. So I was already starting to get in trouble and certain things were starting to happen. I was about 17 years old. I went to a wilderness program and then I went to boarding school. While I was out there, I was still in communication with people in Laguna and they're like, you won't believe what's going on. You know, they're MTV's here and they're shooting a show, which the show was based off of the OC, like with Misha Barton and stuff like that. And it was like the real version of it. And, I heard about it, was like, yeah, it's cool. I ended up, was out in Utah for like, I don't know, like 4 months, came back. And the show was airing and it was doing good. And the producers were like, you know, after it was airing for a little while, they came back and said, it's gotten picked up for a second season. And so they asked the cast, like, who should we connect with? Because some of the seniors are graduating and, you know, Kristen and Talon and everybody's like, you got to meet Jason. He's got a very interesting story. Went and met with them one time and that was it.
What do you think, what part of your story do you think they found interesting that made them want to pull you on the show?
The dating of multiple girls. The, like the life of the party aspect or not nowadays, like looking at the struggle with the alcohol, right? Just kind of like there was the guys component, I think, and it was just outgoing and just kind of at that time, just, you know, was just a little punk and just didn't really care. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, they wanted to have that more involved.
So that character is really what ended up playing out in the show, and it's kind of, it's what they wanted.
Yeah. It's what they wanted. And it kind of just, it naturally fed, right? I mean, as it started to unfold on camera and stuff, it started to become a character that I started to, you know, adjust to, if you will. I mean, mm-hmm. it was me, mm-hmm. But it fed that, you know, fed the ego and it fed the areas of the struggle that I was going through.
Right. So the switch had already been flipped. Alcohol was already involved and what have you. But like, so did the chaos on the show, do you know, are you able to pick apart, like, did the chaos on the show kind of pull you to a place of wanting to drink more, to medicate, or were you already medicating and it just exacerbated that chaos?
No. So I think, like, you know, I was just doing an interview, and I think, like, you know, when I look back and the truth behind this is, when you look at that and you watch the show, and like, I sit back, I actually watched it. It was on when it came out on Netflix, me and my wife were like dying laughing, and we ended up watching a couple episodes, and it really hit me. I was like, you're really watching somebody that was really just sick and really struggling. Mm-hmm. And for me, like, to see that, like, there was all the stuff that I'd shared with, you know, prior, was that's still what I was experiencing and trying to deal with, but I was not able to vocalize or share what was really going on. And so that internal struggle was really there. And so, like, somebody that you, for when you're watching that, you're watching somebody that's really sick and that's really struggling with alcoholism, and a loss of identity.
So for you, it sounds like what was happening on screen was actually real. Unlike a lot of,
yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, for me, cause like again, I'm friends with all the cast, Laguna, and everybody's experience was a little bit different. Even we did, you know, Kristen and Steven had their show Back to the Beach, and we did it, and it's like they had really set up scenarios and different things. Like, I don't think they could set up scenarios because, like, you never know what you're going to get when I was showing up. And so, like, I think they just took what they got, and that was my experience. You know what I mean? And so, because it was a soft scripted show for sure. Mm-hmm. And, but for me, it's like I had a different experience because, like, there's times I'd be on set and I just walk off, like, you know, not like this. I was just, let's go do something. You know what I mean? I was being a punk. And, but for me, is I think they took what they could get, because half the time I was filming, I was drinking. I mean, right. At least probably not more.
Do you feel like, your crew and cast, did they know that there was a problem and what was going on?
I don't think anybody really knew, like, no, not to the level. No, I think nobody really understood. Again, you're 17, 18 years old. I think everybody's kind of going through the motions of it. Yeah. You get this thing that's thrown into you that nobody can relate to or understand, like having a TV show following you around at 17 years old. That was the first of it. I mean, the only other show that was out at that time really was like The Real World.
Right.
And so there was not, like, again, there's, I think in the context of what we were in, there was not many people that could relate to, like, kind of what was going on. And so it was very new. It was very different.
Mm. Yeah. How did you deal with life at that point because of fame? You're talking about how it was new and different because there wasn't really a lot of that going on. Nowadays, we have all these people talking social media, you know, and when people find immediate, basically almost immediate fame, like what happened for you, how did life change what seems like overnight, and what was that experience like for you?
The experience was, it was crazy. I mean, I'll never forget. I think it was, you have to remember too, there was no YouTube, there was no, right. You know, there was no social media. People watched cable TV. And so, I mean, it was like, I think there wasn't such a dissolution or a dilution, if you will, of all these different networks and different things. I mean, like, you had your cable television, that's what you watched. And
yep.
I literally think it was even just the commercials had aired for the show. And I went down to the gas station in Laguna, and it was just like game over. Like, I mean, this car got bombarded, and it was like, whoa. So you take somebody, you know, that, you know, has an overinflated ego with an underestimated sense of self-worth, and you're just adding fuel to the fire. Mm. And so, it was crazy. And obviously, again, there was obviously components of it that were cool or fascinating. It was, an interesting, you know, experience. But again, it was a double-edged sword, you know, I mean, cause there was also a lot of stuff that came with it on the negative side.
Sure. So behind the scenes was, is there a way, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot going on behind the scenes, but if you were to put into your own words now, looking back, was there a narrative for you that was a thread that was woven, or was it literally just the same thing going on behind the scenes as it was in front of the camera?
No, I mean, I think it was probably worse off camera, you know what I mean? In certain aspects. I mean, that's the other thing too, is I think they only could show so much, right?
Yep.
With what was going on. But no, that was when the struggle really started. And, you know, then there, it progressively got worse. As we know, you know, addiction is primary, it's chronic, it's progressive. Mm-hmm. And so, that was really kind of where it started to dovetail and tailspin. It was after Laguna going into the hills.
So take me on that journey, what that was like, the spinning out of control and the consequences that you started to receive.
I think, like, you know, initially the transition is losing friends, losing, you know, good relationships with people, public humiliation, arrest, treatment, you know, hurting people. You know, it was a very toxic cycle that really you know, pulls you down. And you know, I think it was one of those things where it's literally, I came up with this acronym, even like when I was in treatment one time, is like, you develop so much shame. And shame to me at that time was like, you created this self-hatred against my existence, right? And like, that was like, that's kind of where it went. And I went from being this very outgoing, again, like even when I was struggling at 13, 14 years old with the OCD, I was still a very outgoing, loved people, loved being outdoors, had my internal issue that I was dealing with. But as the year started to chip away, I stopped becoming those things, which ultimately led me to, you know, isolation, you know, literally having parties and being in my own room while the party's happening in the living room and not partaking in it. And, and you know, then it goes and fast forwards to the, you know, towards the end where it's like, you have everything that society says is amazing, what you think, whether it's money, it's notoriety, it's fame. And, you know, for me, that was, you know, it doesn't do much for you, because it led me to not contemplation, but attempting suicide. And so, you know, it's a very lonely place. But I think, like, when I look at it for me and from a 50,000 foot view looking at it, it's like, I look at like this person that had a great childhood, who had a lot going for him. That was literally it was like a pickaxe slowly chipping away the things that he had loved to, you know, and watching his life be kind of completely taken away from him. And to losing everything, like literally that was important to me.
Right.
And again, the beauty of it though is you can gain that back, but that downward spiral, when you get to that place where you don't feel like there's a way out, it's a lonely spot.
Absolutely. And out of reverence for what you just mentioned about being in a place where you attempted taking your own life, what do you remember the mental space that you were in at that point? And what were you thinking? I mean, that almost sounds like a dumb question, but because I know that you were feeling, you know, everybody is very, very similar thoughts, right? When you're at that place, but there's some nuances. And what take us on that?
You know, it's I don't really know how to describe or share, you know, that, I mean, because it took some time to get to that spot. It's not like it was for me. And again, everybody's story is different. But it was a combination of just the constant, you know, just falling down and not being able to get back up. I use that just in the term of just, I feel like it was just like, just, I just kept getting steamrolled from my own addiction. And it gets to a place where you know, for me in that spot, it was just like, you know, you can't, like, I couldn't just grasp hold on just the simplest task anymore. You know what I mean? And it was, and even though I had, it's like, it was, I forget the term people use. It's like, I mean, there was a people full room, right? But I still felt lonely. I forget the
people. Yeah.
It's like, I had all the support and all this stuff, but it was just like my addiction, like the way that it literally like hijacks your brain, and the way that my frontal cortex like literally stopped working. You know, and I wasn't able to make, you know, I wasn't able to make even like, I literally lost the right to make my own decisions. And I was just in this place where I couldn't get out of that. And that it was, it just seemed like the only way out was to end it, you know? Mm.
So what happened, after your attempt?
Ended up getting out of the hospital. From there, you know, there was, ended up, I think like, this is, that's where it's like a lot of this stuff was a blur. Like, again, as I know the context of the story, like after the hospital came out, like obviously went and got help, like was able to do well for a little bit on and off. You know, and I say I probably went to treatment again is my guess. After that, definitely plugged into like therapy. And then, you know, I think that was kind of a shift to the turning point. I mean, I know exactly what my moment of clarity was when I transitioned like into like my life of sobriety and like where mm-hmm. I made that commitment. That was, I think, but that was like as a, like a staple of kind of the shift getting from the very bottom and kind of going up the hill from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it still wasn't over after that. You know, I still wanted to go out and experiment, and you know, it's a hell of a journey, you know, that you go through when you're active in addiction.
Yeah. So what led to the point where you finally got sober?
Yeah. So I call it my moment of clarity. again, after the suicide, after all the stuff that had happened, I'll never forget sitting in my therapist office for like the thousandth time, you know, my mom and dad in there. And, you know, I'd never seen my dad really break down besides when his mom had passed away. And, you know, they're sitting looking across at me. And I think this is like, it was right after, so the suicide happened, you know, and I think I ended up getting a DUI. And back in the day, people always thought I had like 10 DUIs. Again, I had one, which is more, that's still more than enough, but everybody always thought I had like 30 DUIs. Uh-huh. I was like, no, dude. But I think I had a DUI, and I was, I think it was kind of like my parents were just at this, that they've been at their breaking point, right? Like I'll never forget looking at them and seeing them physically age 10 years and two. But he breaks down and my dad just looks over and he's just like, Jason, your mom and I don't know what to do anymore. You know, our marriage is suffering. The family is completely like at array. Again, there's some codependency in there. But you know, he looked at me and he's just like, mom and I are like two planks of wood lying in bed waiting for the phone call that you're dead. And when he said that, it just registered. I'm like, I don't know what it was. It was literally like a light came on. And I was like, you know what? I don't care enough about myself. Like I've already tried taking my life, this whole thing, but I do care enough about them. And they became my motivation. And on July 23rd, 2010 is when I went to Florida. And really like, basically that was the shift. That was the moment where I really transitioned, into sobriety and, went away. Went to treatment, was gone for 30, 40 days. Had the opportunity, which again, people would have their opinions on this. I had the opportunity to go on celebrity rehab. So I actually went in sober. And I really went in there to change the public's negative perception of the way they perceived me. Sure. And I just knew like, I'd be like kind of like a background prop, which I really was. I mean, you had Janice Dickinson, you had Jason Davis, Leif Garrett, all these different people that were going through it, which is, it's not funny, but it's sad. But I literally was like on, even though it was a TV show being filmed, it was like me watching a TV show that was going on, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I was able to gain a lot of knowledge and experience in there. And then after that was kind of like my end with the TV side of stuff. And I ended up moving back down to Orange County and ended up getting my first like real job at 23, 24 years old, which is one of the most important things because I was really able to find a sense of purpose and passion. And you know, I worked in the recovery community. I worked with Mike Netherton, who was the president of Betty Ford for 25 years, and Paul Alexander at Northbound. And, they really took me under their wing, and I started working with, you know, Dr. Drew took me under his wing, and, Dr. Hedrick, who was the head of Hogan Mission Hospital at the time back in the day. And so I had these amazing mentors, and I really kind of just shifted, and I kind of like put my head down, put the horse blinders on, and really took my recovery seriously. It was good for some time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who, did you stay connected with your cast members? Were they there and supportive of you, or had you kind of like pulled away? And, I'm curious about like what level of relationship y'all maintained beyond that
we're all really close today. But the, during that time, I think people were really just, they didn't know what to do. You know, I mean, it's not that they didn't support or didn't care. It was, they didn't have the tool. They didn't, I mean, you have to look at where we were.
Yeah.
You know, even from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I mean, every 5 years makes a difference. They were supportive, but it's, you know, they're not clinicians, they're not therapists, they're not psychologists. There's only so much they could provide.
Yeah.
Just like any other friend, just being there and being supportive.
Yeah. So who ended up being your primary support, or who did you end up like really leaning on through those formative years of recovery? Was it new relationships?
I know it was honestly, it was Dr. Drew. It was Mike Netherton, Paul Alexander, my sponsor, Victor. I had a couple mentors, that were in my life in that early stages of that. I surrounded myself with a lot of older individuals, mm-hmm. had a lot more knowledge, a lot more wisdom.
Smart.
Yeah, I mean, it was more mentor related. I had some people that I had my friends and stuff, but again, a lot of the friends I hung out with, I had to get rid of a lot of friends in my life. And there was, you know, there was some friends that that are still today my best friends that were around, but again, they were just more supportive and, sure. and, you know, we'd go surf, we'd go skate, we'd go, you know,
yeah.
go out and enjoy life. But, when it came to like education, knowledge and perspective of life and where I wanted to go, I always surrounded myself with older people, and still to this day, I mean, it's funny. My wife gets frustrated. She when I say this, we're going to go out to dinner with X, Y, and Z. She's like, dude, Jason, it's like always going out to dinner with geriatrics. Like, you know, like I get it, babe. But, and so it's our standing joke. She loves them, but a lot of my friends are just a lot older.
Yeah.
You know, I do have friends my age, but that, I think it was when you experience a lot of pain and a lot of struggle, you know, you connect and relate to people that have gone through a lot of that. And I think that, again, not saying I'm, you know, hey, look at me. It's, I think that just older people have experienced a lot of the stuff that I've gone through versus right. your traditional 36-year-old, 35-year-old. Mm-hmm. It's, there's not a, you know, there's, again, everybody has their story, but I think for me and what I was going through, just what aligns with me is not many of my friends that were my age that could relate to a lot of the stuff I went through.
Yeah, I definitely get that.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
One of my favorite things that I like to ask people about is, you know, we go through a whole, regardless of how we get sober, you know, there's a bunch of commonalities in the tools that we use, and not asking for all of them, but I'm curious about what were the tools that you developed and learned about that made the biggest difference for you in early recovery and maintaining sobriety?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key things for that were, number one is honesty, being open and honest with myself, surrendering and accepting the fact that I had a disease and there's something that I needed to do about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I really had to, honesty was for me though, is number one. Like I had to get to a place of being completely honest with myself. I mean, when I was active in my addiction, I would be eating a hamburger telling you I was having a hot dog. I mean, I didn't know what right. was the truth from not, honestly. And so,
and believe it too.
And I mean that sincerely. Yeah. Yes. Like, I'm yeah. you know, like, no, bro, you're eating a hot dog. It's like, but so it's, for me, it was honesty was the biggest thing. And again, that was, I mean, cause when I said at the end, you know, after the July 23rd, 2010, you know, I was sober for about 5 years and then I ended up going back out. And that was one of the things is I lost my program. I lost, you know, everything that I did to get to where I was at, I stopped doing.
Yeah.
Right. And so I ended up going back out. And that's a whole nother story within itself. But again, is for me to get back into the sobriety, you know, it was being open and willing to just be honest again.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the thing that kept me the sickest was, not being able to be open and honest.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
That's true in and out of sobriety.
Yeah,
for sure. Speaking of that, things change. Like as we evolve and we grow in recovery, those tools we never lose the need for the tools that you just mentioned, but different ones, newer ones kind of come out of the woodwork, we find. You know, as we move on through the years of maintaining long-term sobriety, I know for myself, something that popped up was I realized, whoa, mental health is a thing too. And most of us have stuff going on aside from that.
Yeah.
And there were more things that even popped up, tools that I needed to help maintain my emotional health, the underlying causes and conditions that further than for me, I did the 12 steps when I got sober, as honestly and thoroughly as I could. But like we were talking about earlier, the longer I stayed sober, the more stuff was revealed. Yeah. So I'm really curious about, in long-term term sobriety, what has changed for you in your toolbox?
I'll tell you. Hopefully it doesn't fall. All right. I'll tell you. You know, look, it's structure and consistency create safety. That is something that is been imperative for me. And I understand that I am somebody that needs structure within my life. And so I have my routines. I have my morning routine and I have my evening routine. And those are something that I implement on a daily basis. And, you know, just some key things from when I wake up, hitting my knees, reading my daily devotional. I read the Jesus Calling. I send out a gratitude list, not only three things I'm grateful for, but not only what, but why. That's where I think a lot of the meat resides in there. I actually will either go to a meeting or I will go to the gym. A gym and exercise is one of the most important things for me. Your brain produces more potent chemicals than heroin. You just got to let it work. Yeah. And so exercise, I mean, it's fascinating learning that. I mean, exercise can be just as, if not more effective than an antidepressant. And then from there, I go about my day. And then at night, when I do an inventory, I do an inventory of not only, you know, I take inventory of where I made faults and where I was wrong. And, you know, if there's things I need to clean up, but in addition to that, after I do the negative part, I do something positive and I identify all the things that I did well.
I like that.
To be able to, go to bed and have a fresh start. And so basically I kind of like bookend my days. And so once I'm done with that, it's out. Then I have a fresh start the next day. And so that allows me to continue. And again, church is a big part of my recovery. I still see a therapist. I've seen a therapist every week for the last 3 or 4 years, consistently. I mean, I have a lot of things that I incorporate. Like I said, there's a laundry list of the things that I do, but as long as I put my program, God and my program is my number one priority and my family falls underneath that, everything else falls into place. If I don't have those things in that structure, I've already seen it. I've already had that happen. Like I was saying, there was that other story that happened after 5 years of sobriety and it took me down to that I've watched how it can be taken away from you if you don't put forth that effort. And so, you know, this go around coming up almost 4 years again is it was a big shift with that. And also my wife, you know, she also needed to get some help and stuff herself, not as an alcoholic or an addict, but as a codependent. Because wherever there's an alcoholic, there's a codependent. Sometimes they're just as sick, if not sicker. Ooh,
can I get an amen on that one?
It's incredible. I mean, what she's been able to do as well though, you know, and how supportive she's been able to be. And I truly, you know, owe her by taking the initial step when I was, you know, when I'd relapsed and I was back out. Cause she met me, we got married and stuff. We met when I had 9 months of sobriety, 10 months of sobriety. We ended up getting married when I had a few years of sobriety. So she didn't see the dark side.
So was it 2010, 2011?
Yeah. We got married in 2010. Yeah. I'm sorry. We got married in 10, 12, 13. Cause our wedding, our 10 year anniversary is on Thursday.
Gotcha.
So
early congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So we got together in 2010, and then got married in 2013. Yes.
She knew the sober you.
She knew the sober me. So when I relapsed and stuff, obviously, I mean, she became in the line of fire of manipulation and all those things. And so I was able to kind of, there's a whole nother conversation that should be had around that. But after a couple years of the back and forth and, you know, the on and off again of the relapse and stuff, she finally, you know, enough was enough and she seeked help and stuff for herself, which ultimately led into helping me.
I'm interested because we've got some time, or if you're willing to dive into that a little bit, because relapse is a part of so many people's story. And especially, I mean, we're talking, you had some time under your belt, and, you know, a relapse where this, you know, wasn't just like a, right, like a slip. There's the things we do, right? Manipulation, the disease takes hold. I wonder if you might speak to that and what it was like.
Well, it's interesting you say that. So I've talked to doctors about this, and again, is my opinion is maybe not in like early stages of sobriety, but like in the stages that I was in, is I don't think relapse is a part of recovery. I actually think it's a lack thereof. Mm. And what I mean by that is after that relapse, I can look back and I can identify all the things I stopped doing that caused me to relapse. And so again, there may be, because again, if people have diabetes or they have disease, like for me to say like, oh, it is that, it's like those people can't go and have a relapse or, you know, go back into whatever it is that they're struggling with. No, that's, of course that happens. So again, like it's, does that make sense what I'm saying? Yes, like in the early stages of that. But like for me with, you know, once you have some time, I really believe it's a lack thereof. Like you're not putting forth the effort or the endeavors that you need to be doing for your recovery program. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting topic to talk about. Even, you know, maybe you can have a doctor on and talk about that, just because it's, you know, because when I talked to a doctor, he was able to explain that to me with other diseases and stuff, because I do believe addiction is a disease. And mm-hmm. so I don't want to sound contradicting that I don't, you know, relapse doesn't happen in other diseases. So, but I think it's important to talk about. But for me personally, is I saw all the areas that I was deficient and the things that I stopped doing, and I could literally map out the areas that I could have filled in, you know, and to prevent that. Mm-hmm. And basically my life got too busy with materials, with this, you know, chasing the worldly things, and things started to dissipate and my priorities started to shift, and ultimately I went back out.
Yeah. So what did going back out look like for you that time?
So a very interesting story is, so to give you the context of it all, is life was going really well. Again, stopped doing the things that I needed to do. I went and saw my psychiatrist, who's known me for forever. I was talking to him about, you know, just where life's at, everything that's going on. I was prescribed Adderall as a young kid, mm-hmm. and I never really liked it. And he's like, hey, let's try, you know, you took this when you were like 12, 13 years old. Like, let's maybe try to get you back on this. And again, knowing that, you know, somebody that loved cocaine and loved, you know, just loved uppers, you know, probably was not the smartest thing, but I really had no intent of abusing this. Mm-hmm. But I was, the dominoes had already fallen, mm-hmm. right? And I was already at that weak point. And, you know, after a month or two, I always tell people I ended up getting prescription dyslexia instead of taking one every 8 hours, start taking eight every 1 hour. And it was just off to the races, man.
I think I had that too.
Yeah. And so from there, it's just, it kept unfolding, you know what I mean? And I was hiding it, you know, and I wasn't explaining what, you know, I wasn't telling people what was going on. And that's the thing, is like when I was 18, 19, 20, 21, you know, up to 23, is like 9 out of 10 times I'd get in trouble, like, mm-hmm. you know, guaranteed, you know, shit storm's going to happen. But this time around, it was almost like I perfected my use. Nobody knew I was using. Mm-hmm. And so I used on and off. And again, it wasn't like it was a 3 year straight bender. You know what I mean? Right. It was like month on, month off, like trying to figure this out. Like, you know, what do they say? Head full of, or a belly full of booze and a head full of, you know, program is not beneficial. And so it was a constant struggle. You know, used for, on and off for about a year until I got into like a psychosis and you know, sleep deprivation and all the things that come along with that. So I started drinking again to mm-hmm. just to go to sleep.
Sure.
You know, and I always tell people, like, you know, my addiction at first, you know, like, or drinking and using, right? At first it was fun. It became a lifestyle, and then it became a way of survival. So like during this relapse, it wasn't like I was out partying and stuff. I'm talking about, this is solo use in my house by myself.
What was the story you told yourself, and what was the story you were telling your wife at the time?
What's the story I told myself, and what was the story I was telling my wife? I mean, it was simple, dude. I wasn't using. I was just telling her that she didn't know, until it got to a point where she started finding uh-huh. stuff. And I mean, that's, I honestly would have to think about like what was going on through that. I don't have it like right off the top of my head, but it was, I remember it was just a very toxic situation where, obviously, after, you know, multiple months, she became very clear, that I was using, and she'd find bottles and things like that. And it would basically, it was, you know, I told her at that time, I'm just like, look, you can't tell anybody about what's going on. You can't share this. It will ruin everything that I have going on. And, you know, I was literally working and trying to help, like, and again, this is not like a justification. I mean, I was literally dying while I was trying to help people. You know what I mean? And it was a bad spot. But again, she just kind of took that, like I said, as a codependent, and just was feeding into that. But ultimately it landed in a really bad place. It ended up going to a spot where I ended up back at Hoke Hospital on the first floor at detox while Ashley was giving birth to our daughter on the fourth floor.
At the same time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What year was that?
2018.
Wow, man. That packs a punch.
Yeah.
Is that your youngest?
My daughter.
No, you have a younger one, right?
Yeah, so Delilah is my daughter, she's six, and then Wyatt's two.
Okay.
So that's the oldest.
Okay.
Yeah.
My gosh, what was that like? I mean, not everybody can say they went through an experience like that. We all go through shame and guilt spirals of this shit that we do. You're in the hospital while your wife's having your baby, your first baby. What on earth was going through your head?
I mean, it was a very low point, man. You know, I don't want to talk too much about it.
Sure. Okay. Fair enough. I'm glad you were there, though, and it led to where it did.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got a beautiful, lovely family now.
Yeah.
Yeah. My gosh. But the talk about the gifts of sobriety. I want to know about relationships, because, you know, with your family, with friends, how have those changed now versus previously, in and out of sobriety?
I mean, everything's changed, you know. I mean, since I got sober, you know, I'm a firm believer you're a product of your environment. And so I've surrounded myself with a lot of really good people. I have a lot of good friends, a lot of people that, you know, it's my biggest thing in life today is, like, it's all about the love you have, the memories you create, and the legacy you leave behind. And so, I surround myself with people of that nature, and that have the same morals and values, that are wanting to do that. I don't take myself so serious anymore. I look at my life, at where I'm at and what has been able to be accomplished, and just being somebody that's accountable, that has a purpose, that has passion, that loves what he does, that, you know, that has a family that's made it out on the other end of this and has an opportunity to, you know, be a beacon of hope for those that are lost, is really important. And, you know, it's crazy how God works. I never thought, you know, it's funny. I used to always say, I was like, I don't think I was ever make it past 21. And to be, you know, where I am today, and to see, like, going back to when we were talking about, you know, the baseball career, just the different things that I would have done. You know, I'm really grateful for where things are at today. I mean, I love the life that I have, and, like, I can actually look you in the eyes and be able to say, like, I really like and love the life that I have. And I'm just so grateful for everything that's opportunities that have come and the challenges that I had faced, because I, you know, your greatest deficits can become your greatest assets. And so,
absolutely.
You know, and our world's in a really, really dark place. And it's, you know, it's more discussion needs to be had around things like this. And so I think this as a whole, I mean, I went from somebody, like I said, that was, you know, completely unaccountable, unreliable, didn't know the truth from what was true from not, to everything being completely different. And again, like, just having purpose and passion, I think is one of the best things, to be able to wake up and feel motivated.
I could not agree more. And I know you're using that today. You've been doing it for a while, but I want to learn more about how you're using that today, and some of the stuff that you've got going on and what you're putting in your
Yeah, man. So I ended up joining forces with Dr. Daniel Amen. So I work with him very closely. I'm the director at the Change Your Brain Foundation. And so there's a lot of amazing work going on there. We primarily focus on research, education, and we do scholarships over there. The other stuff is we have stuff locally going on here in Tennessee. Did a PSA with the Prevention Coalition and the Health Department, which is raising awareness for those that struggle with substance abuse and or mental health. Again, on that, you can find out what is addiction, what are the signs and symptoms, what do I do if my child's struggling, all the way to hearing, your favorite athletes, your favorite actors, actresses, talk about how they stay strong or what they do to maintain their sobriety or just very, very relatable topics. And so, love doing that, doing a ton of stuff. And
how can people, watch that?
If you go to You Are Not Alone, TN for Tennessee, .com, I think it's .com or .org. We can put it up there. They can go there and you can actually see the trailer and then you can see all the people that were a part of that process.
That's awesome.
But it's incredible, man. It was, it was the thing that was really special about that. Again, going back to Tennessee and just the passion and the love that the community has, that everybody that came together for that was incredible, from the city officials to the governing bodies to, all the people that came. We ended up doing almost 40 interviews and, people have a heart and just want to give back and help those that are struggling. So those are some of the things that are going on.
You told me an interesting, statistic that I didn't know. The state of Tennessee, what was the highest,
the number one health crisis in the state of Tennessee was binge drinking.
Mm. My drug of choice, drug of slavery, was most definitely alcohol. And man, that hits deep and it goes straight up my paternal bloodline.
I know. I was born Cherokee, German, and Irish. I should have had a stamp on my forehead when I came out of the womb. Should have said no substances.
Right. Yeah,
no substances.
But then you might not be here today. I mean, just saying, doing all the good that you're doing in the world. So
no, I appreciate it, man. And I think just to circle back on the thing in the hospital, it's just, those are this, and I, for context of this is it's, for me, it's like I've worked through those things and there's certain things that I'm learning in my recovery as I'm growing now that I don't need to constantly revisit anymore.
Sure.
Where I used to always share those types of things where, again, it's not towards you, but it's, I've already kind of processed those things. And to me, it's not important to have to share some of that stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. Just because it's personal. And again, I think you can gain the context of what it may be like. Again, I'm happy to share the overarching of what it was like, but to get into the moments of what it was like is, I don't think it's pertinent to the story.
Sure. And you're absolutely entitled to your privacy. So, yeah. But I mean, I appreciate you sharing what you did about it because it's, like I said,
I think it's important to have conversation around that because it is important to show people where this can take you, even with all the knowledge and understanding and support that I had at that time. And at the end of the day, dude, after that had happened, that still wasn't enough. I didn't actively, after I was in detox, went up to the fourth floor, and went through that whole process. I didn't actively arrest the disease. I didn't get stabilized. And I ended up going back out for another like 4 or 5 months until I had to go back into treatment. God. And so that's just how cunning, baffling, and powerful it is when you can go through those things where it's like the thing that I care about, like literally love my daughter more than anything in the world. But like when you're in active addiction, it's like a survival gene. Like that's the only thing that you focus on, the only thing that you think about. And so, I think it's important to share that type of information. You know what I mean? And I think it's just so people can understand where they're going with it and what it can do to you.
Well, and it's two parts because it's like there's the dad or new dad or soon to be dad out there that is tuning in right now that is relating to this story. And this is saying, you're not alone. I did the same thing, but you don't have to go where I went. And there's the wife out there that's listening going, I don't know what my husband is going to do. Like we're in this place, you know? And so like, whether it's flexing, educating for the side of empathy or providing hope, it's a dual purpose, and it's just so wonderful. So
yeah,
I thank you for opening up about that, for
yeah,
sure.
100%.
So to take it from a super serious place, this is the more jovial part of our show. We've got five rapid fire questions. At least I think it's five, and I'm gonna ask you every single one. He has not heard these, so just know that. And we're gonna go one by one, and it's gonna be funny. Okay. So, all right. Who from your castmates would you most rather be stuck with on a cross-country road trip?
Talon.
All right. What is your guilty pleasure TV?
Gold Rush or Pawn Stars.
Good choice. What would your last meal on death row be?
Dude, that's a tough one. Probably a piece of Toro sushi.
Okay.
Probably.
All right. What show? Oh, this is one of my favorites. If it hadn't been Laguna, and you look back, you had to choose a different one. What show would you have chosen to get?
None of them. dude. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I would go on Gold Rush or freaking, what was the duck show that they used to do? The duck
Dynasty?
Yeah, Dynasty. Yeah. One of those.
All right.
Outdoorsy.
Oh, okay. And finally, what should you have gotten arrested for that you didn't?
Oh, bro. I mean, like half
the best one.
I totaled my car on the freeway and the police officer drove me home. Like should have full blown had a DUI, like smash. I mean, it was smashed. Guy drove me home. I mean, I'll never forget that one. Cause I was like, just like how this even, I woke up the next morning. I was like, how the hell did this even happen?
No ticket. No,
nothing.
Wow.
Nothing. Car was just in the impound. Yeah. That happened more than once.
No.
Yeah.
Are you serious? Do you think that you got that? Do you think that you got that treatment because they knew who you were? And it was
one of them. Yes. Because it was like, we're in the height of everything. I mean, yeah. I knew it. The other one, I that was God's grace. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. That was my five.
Dude, love it, man. Great job.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to know what's next for you.
Main thing, like I said, is we got the stuff that we're doing at the Change Your Brain Foundation. I actually do works with some work with A-List Recovery, which is the first ever concierge at home treatment provider. I've mm-hmm. Been working with them for a while, and just doing a ton of the advocacy stuff, man. I try to keep life simple, family, church, God, and go from there. I'll keep you posted as things start to come out.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm glad to learn all this about you, hear more of your story. It's been a real gift to have you on the show today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to close out by asking you for the individual or people that have related and found, you know, encouragement in your story. What final piece would you like to leave with them?
I think if you're struggling, you know, like we've stated, you're not alone. I highly advise that you reach out to somebody, connect. This could be the last day that you ever have to feel like this. So there's a lot of support all around you.
Definitely, definitely echo that. I'll close out how I always do. And thank you again.
Yeah, bro.
Remind you all that it is never too late for you to start loving yourself. And you're always only one decision away from a completely different life. Thanks again for tuning in from all of us at Promises Behavioral Health, and stay tuned for our next episode.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.